about.
Sorry, Jim. Hang on.
There you go. Yeah, much better. Yeah, much better with the headphones.
Brilliant. I'll just secure you. As you can see, I'm having to use this on my phone. I tried to do it on my laptop, and for some reason, the wireless isn't working on my laptop. So we have to use
the phone. That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm very good. Thank you.
Are you managing to get out and about?
Yeah. I was just out for a bit of a cycle before, just to do something, you know. You have to do something. You have to move the body. Yeah. So did a bit of that.
Is it quite rural where you live, John?
Rural?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Very, very rural. Yeah. Oh,
that's good.
Yeah, it's lovely.
That helps.
It's beautiful. Like it's a big tourist destination where I live. It's so, like, the natural beauty is so good, you know. Yeah. Get a lot of people visiting.
Is it in Southern Ireland?
Oh yeah. Yeah, right down the bottom. Yeah. Like if you look at a picture of like a map of Ireland, it looks a little bit like a teddy bear, and I'm down in the feet. the feet part of it. The toes. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
I had my my honeymoon in Killarney.
Oh yeah, well, I'm not a million miles away from Killarney. Yeah. Like so my my wife Maggie works in Killarney, so it's that close.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was lovely. The whole place.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then you know exactly what it's like. It's just gorgeous down here. Okay. Right now, for someone who's listening, I'm not just talking to anybody. I'm talking to Mitch Griffiths. Sorry, that's my dog.
This is a brilliant start to a podcast.
It's going great, yeah. Now, that's probably somebody delivering something. Just give me one second, Mitch. I mean, it's the ultimate dog thing because there's somebody walking by the door, the window, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, murderer. Right. So if for someone who's listening, I'm talking to Mitch Griffiths in a wheelchair. You're still in a wheelchair, are you?
I am, yeah.
Yeah. And just to give time context for our conversation for someone listening in the future, today is Wednesday, the 7th of October, 2020. And here in Ireland, where I am, a lot of drama to do with COVID and lockdown. Up to this, the health advisors and the government have been, you know, on the same page. But at the weekend, the health department basically said, the whole country should go back into lockdown. And then I think it was Tuesday, the government were like, no, we're not going to do that. We'll, it had been patchy, like Dublin had gone into lockdown, not full lockdown, but semi-lockdown. And they're kind of saying, yeah, we'll put the rest of the country in sort of semi-lockdown, but we're not going full lockdown again. So, yeah, that's where we're at here. How are things where you are?
Well, Wiltshire is quite rural as well. So our cases are quite a bit below the national average. We get a lot on the news, but we don't necessarily see a lot of it. You know, when you go into town, everyone's wearing face masks, stuff like that.
And
you've got the room six and all that kind of stuff. So, you know.
Okay, so back in March, when I originally asked listeners to vote on who they wanted to have back on the podcast, you got loads of votes. But when I got in touch, you were unable to do it. Do you want to talk a little bit about why that was?
I got ill, and I still don't know if it was COVID or not.
Because I think at the time you were saying, yeah, I've definitely got COVID, but now
I spoke to three different doctors, and they all at one time said it was. And
well, that would lend one to believe.
But it was right at the start. It was like back in March, and it was happening to me at the same time as the pandemic was kicking off, and So you couldn't actually see a doctor, you could only like call a doctor. And so yeah, when right. I spoke to a doctor like that and just gave the symptoms, and they said, yeah, we think it is. And then of course I had to do all the whole isolation thing and stuff like that. And then I just wasn't really getting better in my chest and my throat and things like that. And it just carried on. And as we went into lockdown, the whole country went into lockdown, then we came out of lockdown and I was still feeling the effects of it. And also very bad kind of fatigue and brain fog and stuff like that.
Yeah. Right.
And then as it carried on, I actually managed to go and see a couple of doctors, and they both had differing opinions of what it was. One said it was pleurisy, and another one said it was something to do with my sinuses and that was affecting my throat and stuff like that. So it was pretty inconclusive, really. And I was told at the time to take it easy, don't push it, stuff like that. So, but I'm a bit of a fitness fanatic. I love my fitness, and it's integral to my artwork and stuff like that, to my creative brain. So I started to get active again slowly, and my symptoms got better.
Right.
So I just carried it on and carried it on and carried it on. And I'm working out 5 times a week now. I've still got a few issues, certain symptoms, but seem to be okay. Seem to be okay.
Yeah. Wow, I can only imagine what that must have been like when everyone was freaking out about COVID and you're told you have COVID, and then the symptoms start to diverge from the standard COVID symptoms. And then, yeah, that must have been really distressing.
It was, but it was more kind of just not knowing. It was just not knowing what was happening. And then as the months go, weeks go by and the months go by, you get more information and more people coming forward to the press and stuff with all these different types of symptoms. And there was one point where I was reading this article, it had 13 symptoms on it, and I had 7 of them.
Yeah, right.
And so you kind of think, it could be. And then I think, well, maybe it's not. And
yeah.
I thought about getting a test, an antibody test to see if you've got the antibodies, if you've had it.
Yes.
But they're so unreliable as well. Any medical test like that is only 70% reliable. And also, the further away from when you had the infection it is, you take the antibody test, the least likely you are to get a positive result anyway.
Yeah.
So I still might do that. I still might get it just to see if I could rule something out. But if it comes back negative, it's still, my doctor actually said it doesn't matter. You could have one, but it doesn't matter. It won't say if you had it or not.
Definitive. We'll never know. Yeah. Wow. Well.
So I'm just treating it as if I haven't had it.
Yeah.
As if I've got no antibodies. So.
Meaning you're just being like careful like everybody else.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds hard. I'm sorry you had to go through that.
It was an odd experience, and I had to take about 3 weeks off from the studio. Then I managed to come back in just for say half a day, something like that, because the doctor said that, you know, I'm not contagious at all. You can't be contagious after that long. And my studio is right by my house, so I don't have to go on any transport or anything like that. And managed to get back to work. And the artwork has been an absolute godsend of just that creative outlet that gives my head space to work, I suppose. The only bit where it got really hit home, really, was when it was the... I just started to have one of the symptoms from the night before. And then the next morning I got up from the table and I thought I was going to pass out.
Oh, right.
And I said to my wife, Kathy, I said, I'm feeling really funny. I'm going to pass out. And so we both looked at each other, and our son was there, and we just thought, well, okay, so I've got to isolate now. So we got one of the bedrooms and I went in there and I shut the door and shut myself in. And my son, like, he's 10 and that, he just said bye. And then they just bought me meals for the next 10 days.
Oh, God. That must have been terrible. And how are they? Like, that must have been really harrowing for them as well.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's a funny word there, because I wouldn't describe it like that at all for me. And I don't really think it was like that for them. It was because I'm quite a fit individual anyway. So at no point, it's in the back of your mind, but at no point did I think anything bad was going to happen. And I wasn't entirely sure that I had it anyway. So.
Ah, good. So you still don't know. So you just left with it, really. That's weird. But you're mostly better, so that's good. When you were telling, when I was listening back to our chat the last time, and you were talking about working with the Terps for all those years, I was wondering if it had kind of did you feel like it had weakened your lungs at all, or any, or there was any kind of connection with that. But it sounds like it's just sort of some random thing you just happened to get.
No, it has crossed my mind. But I didn't use Terps for long. I switched over to like Sansodor and low odor thinners and stuff like that. And before I was using oils, I used, acrylics.
Acrylics, oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, and my studio's pretty big here. It's a warehouse. It's got good ventilation.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So what artists are you enjoying at the moment?
Who do I like at the minute? Justin Mortimer.
Yeah.
Have you heard of Justin Mortimer? Yeah. I love his stuff. Yeah. Doyle Kamey, she's quite good.
Yeah. Anybody new? I don't ask you all the same questions again, but so it's kind of like, because everyone's in lockdown or variations on lockdown. So we're all kind of, you know, more time online. So yeah, just wondering if you'd seen anybody new that we're really excited about.
There's a guy, he's represented by Arcadia Gallery, and I can't remember his name. It's he's a Chinese guy. So now when Arcadia Gallery posts their stuff, he's got an exhibition there right now at the minute. So they're putting all the stuff online. So you can see who it is. I just can't remember his name.
I think I know who you mean. I can't think of his name either.
I like his stuff.
Anybody else?
I'm trying to think off the top of my head, anyone that I've discovered. The thing is with social media now, you kind of see someone every 2 weeks that you didn't know of before. So it's like a, you know, you're flooded with these creative images all the time.
Yeah, it's true.
It's the key is it's the ones that make you stop scrolling.
Well, that's true. Yeah,
I said Doyle Kamey was quite good. She's more than quite good.
Yeah. Now Doriel's brilliant. She's been on the podcast. Right. Yeah.
I don't want to be flippant about that.
Okay, so we've had lots of questions come in on social media. Some you already answered in the previous episode. So some people didn't do their homework. I mean, I don't understand why people don't have time to listen to a whole episode.
I can't remember anything that I said, so maybe I'm cheating myself.
No, I'm joking. All right, so Pau Tria in the Philippines says, how do you come up with your ideas for your paintings? It seems like they have a deep interpretation that digs through the inner side of yourself.
I suppose every artist's work is a reflection of themselves to some point. How do I come up with my ideas? I suppose it's a real cop-out answer, but I just get my ideas from everywhere. And at the minute, they're literally coming out the walls, aren't they? If you turn on the TV, any kind of media outlet, and you're bombarded with everything.
Yeah.
So it's from everywhere. I think the more important, it's not necessarily ideas maybe that you could, or information that you're presented with, it's how you then interpret that into what you want to say.
Yeah.
And for me, I think I've said this before, I use kind of a creative circuit board. So I take one topic or one idea, and I'll join it up with another one, then another one, and see what the mix is like to create a visual image.
Yeah. Have you got any idea of why one thing stands out for you more than another? Because it sounds like you're a little bit of a magpie in terms of inspirations, like you get little nuggets from different things, disparate things, and then you'll have this little nest full of stuff. And then, you know, out of that, then you'll kind of join, as you say, join dots that wouldn't have been joined before.
Exactly.
But have you had any, I mean, you may not be able to answer this, but have you had any idea, any sense of why something really resonates with you? It to go into the nest, if you like, following that bird analogy.
I suppose it's just if something may just interest me, or something is in the public consciousness, then obviously it's going to interest me. And then if I take it one step further in regards to maybe interpreting it into a visual image in my head, if I get a tingle up my spine or some kind of rush, then I think, oh, I think I'm onto something here.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But I literally do get it. I get like a hit, a creative kind of hit, thinking, I've got an idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I can have other ideas and I might just pop them down, write them down, or make a little sketch, and that won't happen. But when I get the, you know, the buzz,
yeah,
that's when I'm really. And also because I know if I feel that, I'm gonna blast through it. I'm gonna work as hard as I can, and I'm totally committed to it.
Yeah, yeah, very good. Okay, Chasley Johanna in Canada says, "Hello, Mitch and John. I'm a huge fan of the podcast. John keeps me company while painting. That's great. Mitch, your technique is beyond incredible. My question is, one, what camera do you use for your reference photos, and do you shoot in RAW mode?"
I use a Phase One, and sometimes I use a Nikon D800. But the Phase One is in RAW. All the files are in RAW. And right.
Phase One is a camera, is it?
Phase One's a camera. Oh, Phase One's a camera system, and I use the Phase One camera. I don't even know what it's called. It's like it's lots of letters and numbers. I know how to click it and take pictures with it, and that
sounds really impressive. Like what's Phase One? What's a Phase One system? I haven't heard of it before.
It's a medium format camera. So they use it on fashion shoots and editorial shoots.
It's bigger than 35mm.
Yeah, you have a special kind of like back that you can put onto the lens holder. It's, to be honest, it's a bit like a high-performance racehorse, so lots of stuff can go wrong with it. I know the bare minimum of how to take the shots that I want to take.
Right.
And that's it.
Okay, and that one's in RAW, and then you have, did you say a Nikon?
A Nikon D800. Which is much easier to use. But it's normally, if one goes wrong, I'll use the other one.
Yeah, right. Back up. Then she says her other question, Chasley's other question is, how do you begin a painting? Transfer drawings or drawing directly on the canvas with raw umber? Or a block-in type paint sketch that I've seen on your Instagram, or something completely different? Thanks so much. I can't wait to hear the second podcast.
I think sometimes it can be, it's normally the paint sketch method. So we'll start with, it can either be raw umber, burnt umber, or burnt sienna, any of the earth colours, and then I'll start with a skeletal kind of form of the painting, maybe. But then as quickly as I can, I'll go into putting some quick drying earth colours on it to create some tone and a bit of colour. Sometimes I might do a Brunel. It's called a Brunel, where it's just like the umber colour, and then I'll work into it, like wipe off and create marks and then wipe off again. So I'll get a tonal, almost finished painting.
Yeah.
And then I'll let that dry, and then I'll go over it again with the colour. It's always different. It's never the same. I try to steer away from technique as much as I can, or just going for one technique.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. William Blake in Chicago says, "Hi, Mitch. Could you talk about your relationship with models? What is that collaboration like? And what do you feel you owe them, and vice versa?"
Well, it's definitely better when you've met with a model a few times. If you've come to the studio a few times and you almost create, you get a like, creative shorthand. So they know the kind of things that I want and I'm trying to achieve with a shoot, and if they're sitting. So when you meet someone for the first time, with a model, you've got a few stages. They can either be recommended to you, or nowadays you can normally find really good models on social media as well. Just normally just distinctive people. And then you'll get in contact with them. And then if they contact back, then you get into a dialogue of what kind of thing that you thinking that you they could be useful for, that you could use them for, and they could help you create. And then it's the meeting in the studio. And at any moment, and then you take the shots or you do sketches and see if it works with the idea. And at any moment along that timeline, it could be it's not working. And it's not the model's fault. It's not necessarily my fault. It's just that it doesn't marry up with what is in my head.
Yeah.
So that's why normally I'll work with some models quite a few times if the working relationship is good in the studio and the idea that I've got in my head, I'm able to put that onto canvas with this person. This person has basically just been, they're implanted into the idea and they work with the idea in my head.
Right. Okay. So based on William's question, so it's not really a collaboration as such. It's more they're kind of funneling in behind your vision. It's not like the model's going, hey, why don't we get a crucifix and I'll hold it. You know, it doesn't sound like that's going on or at all.
I've had some people make some suggestions, but I mean, then everybody does.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, yeah.
So, but normally I've got quite a good idea of what I want to achieve. If it's a highly composed, most of my pieces are highly composed. So if it is a highly composed piece, I'll literally be there saying that you have to move your elbow up. Now move it up a bit. Now move your wrist down a bit. Now that finger has to move. And now just tilt your head the other way. And it normally ends up with, I'll ask permission and say, look, can I literally just move your arm that way and this way and all that kind of stuff. And it could just drive them mad. But if they come to the studio a few times, they know my working methods. So they know what to expect.
Yeah.
They normally need like a protein shake afterwards because I've got them do a squat hold or something like that.
Very good. Do you feel like you owe them anything or vice versa? He says, what do you feel you owe them and vice versa? I don't know what that really means.
It's mutually beneficial, isn't it? I mean, they get paid to do their job and they're also getting exposure from it. And if I use a model quite a few times, then in the past, you know, I've given them a paint sketch or something like that.
So. Oh, okay. Oh, nice. Okay. John McEntee says, how important is the environment in which your figures inhabit? Do you have the background clearly mapped out in your mind or does it evolve as the figures laid in?
I'd love to say, yes, I have it all mapped out, but no, I don't. Sometimes I may do. And even if at the start of the process, I do have it, it will invariably change. It always changes because it's a fluid process. Like I say, I may draw a composition first, but then when the models come in, the light doesn't fall the same way because the dimensions of their bodies are not exactly the same as my drawing.
Yeah.
So, and things are always changing and always fluid. So, I mean, I think you've seen on my Instagram account, I've changed compositions halfway through. I'm always doing it. But I think that's good. I think it's good.
Yeah. Okay. Anita Koster in Holland says, how did you paint the background and all the different color nuances? Do you use glazes?
Again, sometimes. Sometimes I'll use a glaze, sometimes I won't. It normally ends up in a glaze.
Right.
Yeah. I'm just trying to go through. Yeah, every painting's different. There's no magic bullet.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of one of your your system is like no system. It's like it sort of sounds like that. You have to work like that, or you don't have to, but that you choose to work like that because it keeps it vital and interesting and alive for you. Would you say that's right?
That's true. Yes, it does. It does.
Yeah. Okay.
And Carl also, Frank... I think that translates onto the canvas as well.
Yeah, in what way?
I think that if someone is following techniques too rigidly, I think you can see it.
Yeah. How do you register that?
again, I don't know if the, I can't just pick one out of the air of how you.
Well, no, I mean, what I mean is, for me, like when I see that kind of thing, it just looks a bit dead. It doesn't have life.
Yes. Yeah.
Same.
I'd say the same. Yeah. I've always said that it doesn't matter how a painting is painted, if it's ultra hyper realistic or if it's impressionistic, or even an abstract painting. If the painting breathes, then it's works.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Okay, Carla Frank in South Africa says, hi, Mitch and John. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Composition. Is composition a set thing, or do people experience composition in different ways? I'm self-teaching and drawing and painting rather instinctively. If I want to strengthen my compositions, what should I be looking for? Mitch, your work is exquisite. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. If you want to strengthen composition, that's a difficult question to answer. So a lot of people have asked me, why don't you teach? And one of the reasons why I don't teach is because it's very difficult for me to translate my method, because my method is anti-method. I have looked at some books, like Solomon J. Solomon's book about composition and stuff like that. So if you were to look at all that kind of thing, and there's lots of stuff on the internet about composition and why certain things work and why certain things don't work. So I think just lay the groundwork and have a look at those, and then just follow your instinct. Because, you know, yep, you can look at a painting and you know if something is working and if it isn't working. And the main thing is to be fearless. If it's not working, change it.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think, I have found that photography is very good for composition because it's low investment. You can try lots of different things. You can learn a lot very quickly without having, you know, to. Because what happens, I think, with people, and certainly with me with paintings, is you can get too invested in it and then you don't want to. I mean, you're different. You just can obliterate and move things around. But I know for myself, like, I can get too invested in a painting and then I don't want to mess around with it. Even if some part of me is going, yeah, that's not right. You have to got to move that over or whatever, you know. So photography is a great way for sort of quickly learning those kind of compositional mistakes.
Yeah, I agree. That's really good. And also, you could take advantage of Photoshop, I suppose. Photoshop gives you the opportunity to cut and paste images together. And then I can't really use Photoshop, but if you could get color photocopies of quite a few photographs that you've done and then literally cut them out into pieces and then just place them together, gives you more of an idea.
Yeah, yeah. Very good.
But the thing is, what you say about the photography now, I mean, you're talking about actually using a camera. 99% of people will use their iPhone. And so what can you do with the iPhone? You're not thinking about, you are thinking about the perfect shot, but instead of taking that one shot, maybe you'll take 10, 20 shots, but then you can look at what you've taken straight away.
Yeah.
And then what you'll do is you'll delete all of them and keep the one that you like, whereas really keep all of them and then go back and look.
Yeah. Why they're not working. The ones that don't work, or the ones that you wanted to delete. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because also the ones that don't work, they're valuable as well, because then you can look at them and say, why don't they work?
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes, like knowing what, you know, like the classic thing of having somebody looking at the side of a painting or a photograph is, you know, like, theoretically, that's very bad composition. But sometimes it's really useful to do that because it disturbs you, and maybe that's what you want to get into your paintings. So yeah, looking at the wrong photographs would give you that sort of thing as well.
Yeah. But also composition to a certain extent is personal choice as well, especially with a lot of modern paintings. There's almost like an anti-composition thing going on as well.
Yeah.
So it depends if you like heavily composed art or not.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of your paintings look, they have an atmosphere of classical paintings, like the subjects and the dress is contemporary, but the way they're composed looks like very much older paintings, like Renaissance paintings or religious paintings or that kind of thing. And that's another useful way of doing it. If you're not sure about composition, I've heard other artists say that, is like, find a painting that you like that compositionally, and then reproduce the composition part or close to in your own way, or kind of analyze it, you know?
Yeah, I'd say go to a museum, but if you can't go to a museum right now, go online and you can have a look at museums online and you can tour them and have a look. But yeah, that's definitely what I did. I went to all the museums and just marveled at all of these large compositions. And they, and it's used now. I mean, even if on like fashion shoots and editorial shoots, you'll see how the ones that are most successful use those elements from Renaissance paintings.
Okay, some palette questions. Jenny says, I'd like to know your go-to palette. And then Neil Hansen says, the last time you were on the podcast, you mentioned how you use a lot of Indian yellow. Can you give some examples of the way you use it?
Indian yellow, you use it right at the end. It's got a really strong tint power, and it gives a really good kind of iodine-y kind of colour. It's a bit deeper and a bit more burnt than cadmium yellow. And it's got a very high oil content as well. So it's got a certain kind of value. So it works well with glazes. That's the reason why I would use it, but it takes an absolute age to dry.
Yeah, okay. How long?
If you put it on thick, it could take a couple of weeks.
Okay. Okay, Lee Coxon in the UK says, hi, John, great news on getting Mitch back on. Without a doubt, one of my favorites. That's you he's talking about. I could ask many questions, but I'll just ask two quick ones. How many hours a day in the studio and days of the week in a studio?
At the minute, it's between 7 and 8 hours a day, and I do 5 days a week. So my son's at school 5 days a week, and then I just treat it like a 9 to 5. In the past, I have done, you know, I've done overnighters, and I would work for 12 hours a day, and I've experimented with lots of different kind of formats of how to get into the zone, how to achieve flow, and how many hours I can stay there. And it's probably about 4 hours, which is the most that I can consistently stay there, where I go into a 4 hour zone and that 4 hours is then just gone. And I'll stop and have something to eat, and then I'll try and get another one in the same day, which will probably be, maybe I can do 4 hours, but it will normally be 3. In the past, when I've done lots and lots of hours, I've been in the studio for lots and lots of hours, but I wouldn't necessarily have made, that wouldn't translate to more quality work or work that I was happy with.
Yeah.
I'd do more work, but the quality would drop off a bit. So it's finding that perfect point of, to make use of the time that I have and to use it economically and cleverly. So I can be prolific with the work that I produce, because it's very time consuming, but I don't want to be an artist that never sees his family.
Do you have, like, I notice you do a lot of, just on gone on your Instagram, you know, you'll do a head study or you'll do a paint sketch, and do you do those to warm up or just for your own enjoyment, or like, where did they fit in the context of the bigger paintings that you're working on that might take a lot longer to do?
It's stretching, and sometimes it's the equivalent of stretching, and then also it can be the equivalent of natural art yoga. So you're doing something different. It's funny enough, it's not slower, it's faster, but it's just something different. It affects different creative pathways in your brain.
Yeah.
It just keeps you match fit.
Yeah. And do you have that as like part of your every day, or just every couple of days, or do you do it at the beginning of the day or the end of the day? Like, do you have a routine for that, or is it just part of the now system?
Yeah, I don't do it every day. Or sometimes I might have a week where I do it every day for a week. It's just what I want to do. What I want to do, it seems I can be very disciplined, and so I need to finish that before I can start this. But I know that if I really want to do stuff, another painting and something on another painting, I'll do it while I'm most enthusiastic for it. And then after I've done that initial chunk, then I'll have a period where I become more disciplined and I kind of like tie up the bits that I'm not so enthusiastic about. So yeah. I transverse between being ultra disciplined and going to start to finish, this is what I'm doing, and then flitting about and doing. So it gives me that creative freedom, but it also gives me those parameters, while also taking full advantage of any kind of creative burst.
Yeah, it sounds like you sort of manage your enthusiasm so that you get the most out of it.
Yeah, so willpower, there's a limit to willpower. So, you know, I'm sure you've heard it, if you don't want to eat chocolate, don't keep chocolate around the house. It's little things like that. So these are all these tiny little hacks that I do to make it so I just create the best work possible for me.
Yeah, brilliant. And then his other question, Lee's other question is, if you could only ever use 7 colours on palette and brand.
They'd be Michael Harding. They're the best paints that I've ever used. Titanium White, Burnt Sienna, Burnt Umber, Raw Umber, that's 4. Cadmium Red, a green. Actually, I'd probably use Phthalo Green Lake because it's so strong and the tint power is massive, so I'd only use a little bit. Prussian Blue, that's 7?
Yeah, I think so. I wasn't counting because you're counting on your fingers. Yeah, okay, let's say that's 7. Okay, so Daniel Oliver, again in the UK, says, do you have any tips for getting tones and contrast spot on when starting a portrait? And if you've started painting and your initial tones are off, how would you recommend adjusting them?
If you want to nail tone, practice doing tonal paintings. That's a good exercise. If you've got a weakness, then go over it over and over and over again. So forget about colour. Because you could paint in full colour and get the colours wrong, but if the tones are right, it still looks good. If you paint in full colour, if you paint in black and white but the tones are wrong, it looks bad. Tone is much more important than colour.
Yeah.
So I'd say just do tonal paintings and you don't even have to use like a black and white. You can use an earth colour, you can even use a green or a blue, any colour along with a white.
Yeah. So just to be clear, when you're saying tone, that other people would call that value, tone and value are the same?
Yeah. I don't know. A lot of people talk about value. I'm not really familiar with exactly what value is.
I think it's the way you're talking. I think it's the same. And if it's not, I'm sure someone's going to email me and tell me.
Yeah. I am a Philistine. But the tone is, that is what makes a painting work. Yeah. And then once you've got that down, that's when you can, because when you're painting, it's like the difference between driving a car and flying a helicopter. Instead of just, you've got two dimensions in black and white and you're going from A to B, you've got to think of the tones and the colours at the same time. So you're thinking of hues, aren't you?
Yeah.
So you're thinking concurrently about all these things.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, Mary Stack says, my question is about edges, soft versus hard. How do you approach them?
I'd say normally you want, in your painting, you want different areas where you've got some soft edges. But I think occasionally you do need a hard edge somewhere. So if I've got a figure in the foreground and the light is on that figure, the side that the light is hitting from, I'd probably have a hard edge on that just because I want it to come forward and I want to have the illusion where you can literally reach behind that person.
Yeah.
And also when you look at something, if you look at a scene with your eye, it's not all in super focus.
Yeah.
The only bit is in focus, the bit that you're looking at. So if you have a hard edges on everything, it just lessens. The edges are another tool that you can have to create depth.
Yeah. And just technically, how do you get your soft edges?
You'll get a soft edge on the first pass that you do, probably.
Right.
And then you can soften your edges with glazes, or you can actually blend it on the canvas.
Okay.
It's normally, if you have a hard edge, if you do a hard edge and both sides are wet, you can just put a brush on it with nothing on it, and you can soften it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I think you were talking in the last one about using sandpaper and oiling out, that you can soften up edges that way as well. Do you still do that, or?
Yeah, if you oil out and then go over with a glaze. But sometimes I can oil out and then go over with a full layer of paint again and glaze some of it and then put more earth colours on it. I'm all over the place, really. Again, there's no technique is only half of the answer.
Right. Sam Massey in Australia says, "Hi, John and Mitch. I like the way you describe your painting process as slowly focusing a lens in your previous episode. I also admire your willingness to change your paintings as you go by sanding and oiling out. How do you reconcile these two elements in practice?"
So that again, how does that? I don't quite understand that question.
Okay. He says he likes the way you describe your painting process as slowly focusing a lens.
Yeah.
And he's admiring your willingness to change your paintings as you go by sanding out and oiling. And how do you reconcile these two elements in practice?
It can be a nightmare sometimes. and so part of me I like it when you see different decisions on a canvas. When you see a really good painting, but you can see underneath where the artist has changed their mind, where there's a different narrative. There's almost like you can see the studio narrative to the painting, let alone the narrative to the actual what's depicted in it. You just paint over it. Just paint over it, sand it off, do lots of different things.
Yeah. That sounds like...
I prefer not to change. I prefer to nail it in one go.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like it's not a reconciliation process. It just sounds like it's part of the process. Like as the thing becomes more focused, if you sort of realize, oh, something's got to change, well, that's part of it becoming more focused, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
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 Then he says, "Are the changes evident in the final piece? Are you able to sand back at any point, or is there a point of no return where you're locked in?"
No, I've never been locked in. It's just going back to that thing of, it's a difficult balance because I'll never say a painting's finished, or I'll never say I can't change this now. But then you could have 100 people look at your painting and say, "Well, that's okay, just leave it like that." And I'll say, "I'm not happy with this here." So it might be that I can't see the wood for the trees. And you've got that balance of, does it make a difference if you change it or not? But then it's who's the most important voice when you're making the painting. And you've got to listen to your own instincts all the time. So if your instinct is telling you you need to change something, then I'll always listen to my own instincts.
Yeah. And then his last question is, are you more considerate of transparency or opacity of the paint once you start reworking a section?
Yes. It will look different, and the more layers or fewer layers that are on the canvas, the surface will look different. You'll have to work very hard, almost like to the level of a restorer or something like that, to make it indistinguishable.
Now, if you're thinking to yourself, God, I'm really enjoying this podcast. I've listened to a few now and they're brilliant. And there's so many of them. And I've learned so much from listening to them. And you know what? If I met that John Dalton fella in real life, I'd love to buy him a cup of tea and have a chat with him. I'd love to do that every month if I could. Well, now you can. The tea part, at least, because this podcast runs on cups of tea bought for me by people like you who listen to the podcast and send me the price of a cup of tea once a month through the Patreon account. That's patreon.com/John Dalton gently does it. All one word. And if you're one of those people who already send me cups of tea through Patreon, thanks a million. The tea is lovely and I really appreciate it. Now, the great thing is that if you can't afford to send me the price of a cup of tea or you don't want to, that's fine. You still get exactly the same podcast for free. It's sort of an honor system where the people who can afford it and want to pay for the people who can't or don't want to. So it's all lovely. So if you'd like to send me a cup of tea once a month, you can do that through Patreon. I'd really appreciate it. It makes a huge difference to me. Okay, so Paul Herman, Paul's a friend of the podcast on Patreon. Thanks for the tea, Paul. He says, for an artist of your skill level, are you still struggling with any technical aspects of painting, such as drawing, value, color, composition, etc.? Or does that part of painting fade into the background and other aspects become prevalent? What are you struggling or wrestling with in your painting today?
Okay, cliche alert. The more that I learn, the less that I know. And the better you get, the worse you get. Because your bar, your horizon, just moves every single time. With every single piece of work you do, it gets further away from you. I'd still say that the things that concerned me the first day I used oil paints still concern me. But there is also, there are other challenges that take up the creative space as well, such as, I mean, you've got the mixing of the colours, the way colours go together, then you've got composition, ideas, narrative, and it all goes into one. And if you're lucky, you can finalize a few elements of them and have a day in the studio where you've only got to work on one of them. So if I've got a composition finalized, it's absolute heaven to be in the studio and I just paint a hand. And I know the position of the hand and I'll know the color values, that word again, values. And it's just, it's like, that's like a comfy chair.
Yeah.
Which I don't like to go into very often because I like to keep it fresh.
Yeah. Okay. Paul Berryman, again in the UK, says, your work has been such an incredible standard for many years now. Sorry. Your work has been of such an incredible standard for many years now and has tremendous consistency and Griffithness inverted commas all over it. Do you feel the special Mitch sauce, again in inverted commas, you've cooked up is now too precious and valuable to change? Are there any new techniques, narratives or paths that appeal to you, or is there more still to do with this style and approach? Special minstrel sauce. Very good.
Yeah, I'd just say I'm obsessed. I'm so obsessed with the way that I'm working. I still got stuff to do. The way that I work, for me, again, going back to the idea of technique, the reason I use the lighting that I use is, for me, it works from a painting perspective, an art perspective, but also from a cinematic perspective, because we live in a world of the movie and the film as well. I'm not going to rule out that I drastically change my style in the future. And actually, when I was younger, I used to draw and paint with gouache paint and stuff like that, and acrylic, in lots of different styles. Yeah. But then as soon as I walked into a museum, and my brain was assaulted by this amazing creative imagery, I've never gotten over it. I've never got past it. I'm doing what I want to do.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't, even though I know what he means, and I probably would be able to, you know, look at a painting of yours that, if I wasn't told it was yours, I'd probably be able to guess. But like, there are some artists who are that, you know, they're into that kind of change almost for its own sake. Whereas your paintings, if you were to call them, if you were to say, oh, they have a style, I think that's just a product. That looks to me like it's just a product of your, what you described as your obsession with sort of getting the image in your head onto canvas and, you know, all the different influences that you've come into. It doesn't seem like it's a very self-aware or self-indulgent kind of style. It's just the way you paint. Looks like to me, anyway.
I think you're right. I think you're right. It's not necessarily a conscious thing. Maybe it is. No, it is a conscious thing, because I know, because as I said, like going to the museums, and I was thinking, that's how I want to paint. So I've taken elements of that and made it contemporary in some ways. But it's... Yeah, I don't believe in change for change's sake.
Yeah, well, I can think of somebody like Picasso, you know, who went through different periods, you know, his blue period and his this period and his that period. And that's kind of an expression of him and his mind and the way he worked. But they're very distinctive, kind of, that's in one style and then there's another style. Whereas yours just seems to have been like, it's just, as you say, it's like a product of this obsession. You know, you're sort of going deeper and deeper and deeper into something, and that something happens to manifest itself as your paintings.
Yeah. I mean, but you have to remember, the public sees about 40% of what I produce. So yeah. There's lots of different stuff in different, I don't really want to say the word styled, but yeah, I'm trying to create, with my work at the minute, I'm trying to create a world, my own kind of like 2D universe. So it all kind of connects together. So the way that I paint, for me, needs to be a consistent, and I need to paint in a consistent manner.
Yeah.
But it's never a straight line to me. My painting now from 5 years ago is pretty different.
All right.
In the way that I paint.
What are the main differences?
Just the way that I would use the paint, the way that I mix the paint, the mediums that I use.
Right, yeah.
I'm much more economical with my stroke.
Yeah.
I suppose. And that can also be connected to, then you can connect that to the hours spent doing the painting. Instead of hours treading water, slogging through it, it's get in, be the most creatively fruitful that you can, and then sit back, take a break, and then go in for another one.
Just got back to what you were saying earlier on. So do are all your paintings like a window into a world, like that they're all connected? All the characters and all the things that are depicted, they all exist in a world.
I mean, I've got a story in my head that connects everything, and they're all characters. They've all got names, character names, and there's more stuff as well. There's black and white sketches and different scenarios and adverts in my head and all this kind of stuff.
Ads for products within that world.
Yeah. So if it's because one of the scenarios for this latest series of works is it a big festival? Is it some cataclysmic event that's happened? Or is it just an ad campaign for an imaginary fragrance?
Okay. And do the people in this this world that you're painting at the moment, in this current body, is that the same world as the previous body, or is that a separate world?
Characters from the previous one can come into this one.
Okay.
There are no rules.
There are no rules. Good. Okay. James Sizemore says, how can we paint to look like ZBrush?
What's that?
Yeah, I had to look it up too. I thought you might know. That's why. ZBrush is a digital sculpting tool that combines 3D and 2.5D modeling, texturing, and painting. So, okay, neither of us know the answer to that question. Sorry, James.
Can I get that on the phone? Can I?
ZBrush.
I suppose it's an app, is it?
I'm not sure what it is. I have a feeling it's a 3D modeling thing. So, I'd be surprised if it's an app. I wasn't sure. I didn't look into it too much, but it might be one of those things that you like hold. It's like a paintbrush that you hold in virtual reality and you can paint with it. I don't know if you've seen those, but they're pretty. I haven't used one, but I've heard they're a lot of fun. Okay. So it's almost like you can build sculptures in three dimensions.
Okay, you can kind of carve.
Yeah. But you have to wear the goggles and stuff to do it with. Yeah.
You can look cool doing it. You can look cool doing it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like people wearing those virtual reality goggles, they always look, because they're so involved in what they're doing, they usually look silly, yeah. Like because they're, you know,
they look
swimming
like,
or they're whatever.
They look like the whole thing is being filmed in the nightlight kind of thing, that nightlight that enables you to see in the dark, and it's someone walking around their house and they've gotten up out of bed and they can't see. And they're just walking around with their arms out.
Yeah. Okay. Steve Schmiller in Canada. He's brilliant. He was on the podcast as well, former podcast guest. He says, hello, John and Mitch. Mr. Griffiths, love your work. My question is, what part of your process are you able to use assistance on? I ask because I've had trouble delegating creative assignments to others. At this stage in my career, I want to make things more efficient, but feel it's quicker for me to just keep doing everything I already know how to do rather than teach someone else, which leaves me with many 12-hour days.
Well, I've got an assistant here, Ed. He was full-time, but he's actually gone down to one day a week because he wanted to be a house father.
Yes.
So he's got two young children, and him and his partner, they made a decision that he was going to be the at-home parent for the children. Mm-hmm. So that was at the start of the year. So for me, that's changed things for me quite a bit, but it's also made me more focused into anything that I need help with. So Ed is the person that would do stuff on a computer for me and order materials. He might speak to models, stuff like that. So that's one day a week. So that gives me that little bit of structure. So it's just whatever help you can get, really. If you're lucky enough to be in a position where you could actually employ someone, be it for maybe just a few hours a week, then do it. But it's very difficult to, I mean, things like admin and stuff. You know, I don't envy someone else doing that, But in regards to anything to do with my creative process, it's really, really difficult. I've tried it in the past with having help on certain things, and it just hasn't worked at all, because I've basically just, they've wasted the time doing whatever they're doing, and it's my way, basically. it's a really difficult thing to do. I mean, I know you know you've got some really successful artists who, what's his name, is it Yigal Azeri? Have you heard of him? And he's got 10 assistants that paint his paintings for him, and he'll finish the paintings off. And so I think the arrangement he's got is for 4 days they'll paint for him, and then for the rest of the week they can do their work in his space.
Right.
But he gets 10 times the amount of work done,
I'd say. Yeah.
But it's a very difficult, but I couldn't have someone else's hand on my painting.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a, like, that's the way a lot of the Renaissance artists worked.
They do
the heads and the hands, and that's it.
Yeah.
So it's not unusual, but I don't know how you could do it. But
also, painting in those days was a different commodity.
True.
There was no photography. If you needed someone, you know, unless you had a really good memory, you could remember what everyone looked like you met or in your family. It was the only record you have of how people looked.
Yeah.
So it was serving a different purpose, along with being extravagant for people who can afford it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've often see it in those period dramas, particularly when someone is, you know, like the young prince or the young princess is getting married, and they send these little tiny cameo pictures, and that's all they've got to go on, you know. Yeah. Well, there's the princess of Holland. What does she look like? And they're looking at this tiny little thing, you know.
and then you can put yourself in a difficult position like Holbein, where you've got Anne of Cleves court saying, paint her like this. And then him having to go back and show Henry VIII, and then when she turned up, it wasn't a good likeness.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Patricia Guzman in Mexico says, does painting have another purpose beyond holding a mirror? Do you believe painting can actually transform society? Love your work. So inspired by it.
I think it can, but I think it does so sparingly. I think all the elements have to be in place. I think it has to be an amazing piece of work, and I think it has to be the right time, and I think the world has to be ready for it. Is it Kadir Nelson? His work at the minute, it's really on point. It's a lot to do with George Floyd and stuff, and he's done a few covers for the New Yorker magazine.
All right.
So it's almost like the perfect storm of right time, right place, and amazing art.
But is that a change? That's more holding up a mirror than changing society.
It's holding up a mirror, but it's also, I think it goes a little extra step where that it can make someone think about the situation by looking at that cover more than them reading a news report or seeing a news report. So if you make that difference to even one person, then you've changed the world.
Can you do you have another example of one from like an older one?
No, not off the top of my head.
Yeah, I couldn't think of any. Not really, like the, you know, like that a painting change transforms society. Not in the way that I think Patricia means. Like, I know that, like, I can think of loads of paintings that impacted society.
I mean, back in
changing
the Northern Renaissance, and also back to medieval times, and that then painting was TV. It was TV. It was everything. It was all the media that we had, and people would travel miles to see a painting, and travel hundreds of miles to go to a church to see a painting, see an altarpiece. That radically changed the world. So I don't think, could you say that art
in what way did it radically change the world?
Because it was, people lived in fear of God.
Yeah.
So now we mostly live in a time where I'd say the majority of the world believes in God or a God, but more people now might believe in God, but not necessarily the fear of God, where back in those times, it was the fear of God, and a lot of the paintings were about the fear of God.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
It altered the way people lived their lives. It dictated the way people lived their lives.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Soft Violence, that's their name on Instagram, says, no question. I just want to say thank you for sharing your art, and the advice you give is generous and heartfelt. So I just included that because there was a lot of people said that when I was asking the questions for you. There was a lot of, you know, very, a lot of gratitude, no question, but Mitch is great and he's very generous and he gives a lot of great information out. So thanks for that on behalf of everyone.
Thank you very much. I do feel that a lot of the information that I give is quite muddled, but that's the inside of my brain. It's quite muddled, so.
Yeah, it doesn't read muddled now, I have to say. It's pretty clear.
Okay.
As I read it, it comes across well, yeah. Slightly poetic, I would say as well. Some very nice pieces there about passion and going for it and just, you know, yeah, it's quite good. Quite good writing.
Oh, no, I enjoy doing that. That's another little outlet. And it helps with the painting as well. I do quite a bit of writing about each piece of work. They've all got a story and a synopsis and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I think it it goes hand in hand with it, really.
Yeah. Okay, Philip James Hedgecock in London says, hi, Mitch. You have developed a very beautiful approach to rendering skin texture and keeping an overall balance and atmosphere to the painting as a whole. Have you ever thought about teaching a workshop or even longer course of study to your approach?
I've thought about it. Again, going back to what I said before, as to when I've thought about it and I've started to try and document a format for a course, it would just be all over the place, just the same way that my working practice is. So it would almost be that I could give snippets here and there, but I'm sure what I say about how I paint and how I can convey that would ultimately be infuriating because there's only, I mean, I think the best teacher doesn't try to replicate, doesn't try to make another copy of themselves with their technique, with their students. They enable their students to become the best artists they can be.
Yeah.
Their own individual art. So in terms of positive affirmation and constructive criticism, yeah, I don't think I would, at the minute, I would be satisfied with how I could convey what I feel, what I see to other people in terms of education.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's indefinite. And also, if I do that, I don't paint.
That's true. Well, just I'll pass on my experience. You might find it helpful from that regard. And it's to do with teaching craniosacral, but craniosacral therapy is a very, the physiology and anatomy side of it's very cut and dry, but the technique and how you do it, the way I was taught was pretty vague, right? And then I went to Australia and I was getting the course accredited, the course I was teaching accredited, and I had to go through the structures in Australia. And it was classed as vocational training, so similar to learning how to drive. And part of me was like, oh no, it's all too vague and beautiful and mystical, you know. But I got a consultant to help me. So I got a guy whose job it was to take somebody like me and sort of fit them into the different ways of teaching. And his whole thing had been, like, he'd spent his life devoted to how teaching works and how people learn, which was a complete eye-opener for me. And it was amazing how, you know, just from talking to him and him listening to what I was saying and saying and asking me questions, he was able to wrangle what felt like a wild stallion into a very transferable skill. So yeah, maybe a consultant might help with that for you, because I know exactly what, when you're saying, oh, it's just too all over the place. I can totally relate to that.
Okay, that's interesting. So his skill, that was his skill, was the putting all of the ducks in order.
Yeah, and we ended up producing this huge document. It was like 700 pages. We had broken every single thing down into, now it would be different obviously for yours, because it's, I mean, there's certain aspects that are vocational, as you were saying, like, you know, if you mix this color with that color, you're going to get this result. That's the nuts and bolts of it. But you can't teach someone how to be an artist. That's a different thing. But you can certainly create the environment, the best environment for whatever's inside them to flourish. Yeah. But yeah, you can quantify all that, which feels like very vague. And you can create that environment while also getting very granular on the nuts and bolts stuff as well.
Yeah. No, that's true. And also that itself is just a base platform, isn't it, then?
Yeah.
And then from that, as you go forward, each individual student would react differently to every stage of the process.
Yeah. And I think that's why demos are so popular in art school training. I mean, I haven't, you know, gone through art school similar to yourself, but like, humans learn by looking and seeing, you know, so even just people being around you, watching you paint, they just learn a lot, you know.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. Thing is, if someone was watching me paint, I'd be looking at them at the corner of my eye.
Yeah. Well, the great thing is now you just have to sort of camera your whole studio and you don't have to worry about it. There's nobody
there. Oh, yeah. I see what you mean. Yeah. Yeah. Get a camera set up and do an actual demo like that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've thought about all this kind of stuff, but it's when I come into the studio, the first thing I want to do is just get a brush in my hand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just paint.
Yeah. And like that process I was telling you about that I went through, that took a year, maybe 2 years, and it was painful. Every time that guy came, okay, it hurt my brain to answer his questions and, you know, quantify it all. So, yeah, unless you really want to do it, I wouldn't inflict that on yourself.
I think it's relevant what you were saying about, it's not only painting technique. It's about being an artist and what an artist is and how you... If you want to create good art, then you need to develop that respect for the time it takes and the dedication it takes to do it. And then also, because most people who are students are able to devote all of their focus to it, but also being an artist is not being consumed by it. And in the past, I have let myself a little bit be consumed by it, but you have to remember the greatest work of art that you're going to produce in your life is the relationship with the people that you love. And what you produce on canvas is, you know, that's your hobby, basically, even if you're paid for it. So it's getting that balance and being out in the real world as opposed to being held up in your studio. Your studio is in your head.
That's beautiful. It's lovely to hear someone as successful as yourself say that. It's a great message to pass on.
Very difficult balance. but you literally have to, because as I said, like, studio's in my head, so it's very difficult to completely switch off, and I've trained myself to do it. I've got the outlet of the notes app on my phone. If I think of something, then I'll whiz something down, but you can't be... I don't want to be a person who is just constantly painting or drawing. There are other things I want to do, relationships that I want to have in my life.
Yeah.
I think it's something of a Lucian Freud.
Yeah. I think it's that thing of, like, you know, some, like in other interviews I've done, people have sent in questions about, oh, I'm not sure what to paint, you know, and often the universal kind of answer is, well, you just got to go and live life. You know, if your whole life has just been about painting, then you haven't got any life to paint. You've got nothing. There's no subject matter there. You've got to go and live life, and then you'll have something to paint.
Yeah. I think it's really good to have, because I think, as you know, I did a few other jobs before I was a full-time painter. So I think that's good. It's worked really well for me to have that perspective on life and realize that the majority of people are going to have to spend their lives doing stuff they don't want to do.
Yeah.
And yeah, then to know how precious this is, to be in a position that I am where I get to do this as my job all day, every day.
Yeah. That's great. Right. Patrick Elliott, have you ever tried setting a subject or composition in a historical context to make a point about the world now? Easier said than done, I know.
I have kind of done that in the past with a couple of paintings where I have, you can see the overtones of a Renaissance painting or a Renaissance genre that I've used. Like the rehab picture, bit like a crucifixion, like a modern kind of crucifixion. So that, in that kind of way, I've supplanted one into another from art history. Does it mean from like history of the world?
In a historical context. Yeah, it must be history of the world, yeah. I have a feeling he kind of, well, I don't know, what I get from it is a kind of like, say, if you were, say, the portrait of Ray Winston, like if you painted him in a, you know, period costume, like a really period, obvious period costume, you know, something like that. Something from historical to make a point about the world now.
I get what you're saying, and I do to a certain extent. I feel that there are undertones of that in my work. I try not to be too literal with the choices that I make. So you can only be as literal or as subtle as what you think is the right amount, and then the viewer will take that from a different point of view. So some things in my paintings not everyone will see, or not everyone will connect to, because they're not necessarily, they see something different, or yeah, maybe they miss something, or maybe they see something which I haven't put there but they put there.
Yeah, as I was saying before, your paintings seem more to me to, they have the shape and feel of historical paintings, but they're contemporary, which I think has got a powerful kind of impact. Okay, Shanna Levinson in Mexico says, not in Mexico, in New Mexico, says, do you find that an idea for a painting stems from something happening in the moment, yet tends to transcend into several ideas socially? Meaning a painting you did a few years back that was inspired by one situation can connect to current times. And is that something you intend, or just left to the viewer to interpret, therefore can speak to several social conversations? In brackets, sorry if that's a confusing question.
To the first part, yes. And I find that it can. I think with my ideas, what I try to do is, I, again, going back to this like literal thing. So when President Trump came to office, Instagram and all social media were flooded with images of artists painting Donald Trump. And they were painting him with maybe a clown nose on, or in some other way, or... but there's reams and reams of all these different kind of portraits of Donald Trump. And so in my head, it was like, okay, he's an important figure. He's a divisive figure. And I want to reference him in my work. And I want him to be present in my work, but I'm not going to paint him. So the painting might be about what he has done or how he is in office, but I won't paint his face. So it's not necessarily something that is it's only about him. And then maybe the painting, in the way that I've painted it, might be relevant to something else in the future. If you make something completely literal to one point in time, then it is going to be stuck in that time. It won't be timeless.
Yeah.
So if you're a little bit more subtle, and it's like a face mask, you know, do you do paintings of people with face masks on? Does it make a good painting? Or because I see lots and lots of paintings now of people with face masks on, there must be a way of now, and this is what I'm working on now, of referencing the pandemic and referencing people having to cover part of their faces, but have it in a way which is aesthetically pleasing, which is timeless, and which is not at one fixed point in time.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how possible that is, because your work is always going to be like, it'll have a timeless quality, but it'll be of the time. You know, like we look back on Renaissance paintings and think they're timeless, but they are painting a time. You know, even if they're painting a myth, like a Greek myth, if it was painted in the Renaissance, it still will be dated to the Renaissance. You'll still know, oh, that's a Renaissance painting. You know, it's still within that context.
Yes, that's true. But the best ones resonate now.
Yeah.
With some way, with the relationship, interaction with the figures.
Yeah.
Or something, some element in the painting. That is definitely something that I think about and try to capture in my work.
Yeah. 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 Well, I think if anyone can do it, you can, because of this thing of like I think your paintings are quite timeless, even though they're very, you know, the people will have a cell phone or they'll have, you know, objects in them that reference the time, the current time, but they do have that kind of timeless quality to them.
It's like not holding back, but just making a creative lateral move. And saying, well, how can I make this not quite as obvious? But as I said, one person's obvious is another person's subtle. So you can't second guess how anyone else is going to see your work. It has to be, it's like the equivalent of telling a joke that would make you laugh.
Yeah.
Make yourself laugh.
Yeah. I was just going to say that really, like, if it's not, it has to be pleasing for me anyway. It has to be pleasing to me. Like, like it wouldn't be pleasing for me to paint somebody with a face mask on. That's not to say there's anything wrong with it. It just wouldn't please me. So I would be similar to you. If I wanted to do that, I would be.
You can do it in a composition in a way where you can make it evident that someone is wearing a face mask, but they're not necessarily wearing it.
Yeah. 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 Well, one thing I have noticed with everyone wearing face masks is everyone seems like people's eyes have really come to the fore, you know. It's like you're trying to read a whole facial expression just through people's eyes. And I've been struck by how lovely some people's eyes are. I don't know if I would have noticed that before, like how much there, because it's, you know, it's all you've got to see, so
it creates very focused, doesn't it? And I've got a very deep frown lines, and I've got my resting face is really quite dour. So I notice when I've got my face mask on, I'll really be like, you know, raising my eyebrows and everything. I'm smiling. Yeah, you can see.
Yeah. When we started doing the face mask wearing thing, I had one of the ones that just covered my face, and I discovered people couldn't understand me. It's so funny. Like, I'd be at a cash register or something, and I'd be talking to them, and they're like, pardon, you know, I was like, oh, people must be reading my lips a lot because I never encountered that before. But then I got one of those visor things, you know, like it's like, they're brilliant. It's great. People kind of get a little bit of a shock. They go, hang on, is he not wearing a mask? And then they go, oh, he is wearing a mask. And then I can smile at them, and then they give me a big, well, their eyes kind of smile back at me. I think they're smiling.
Like smile envy. it can be quite problematic, can't it? Like if you've both got masks on, and if there's a plexi screen as well, and there's quite a few other people hanging around, you can hear background voices and stuff. It's pretty difficult to actually to actually understand someone. And it, what it's done is it's highlighted how much of all the five senses that we need, really.
To be able to read people's faces?
Yeah, a whole face as opposed to just the eyes.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah, yeah. One thing, though, since I've had to wear a mask out in public, my ventriloquism skills have just really got a lot better. I'm getting really good at that now.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, if you're feeling so inclined, you can just mouth certain words at people, can't you? If you wanted yeah. to. There's lots of stuff you can say under your breath. So. Yeah.
Okay, Giuliano 99, again, that's an Instagram name, said, will you ever consider producing limited edition prints of your original pieces, making your art more accessible to admirers?
It's definitely, I think we've said this before, it's definitely something that I want to do. It's just the logistics of it. I work with a gallery and it's just deciding together when is the best time to do that and then what pieces and stuff. So,
yeah. Is that book from the Hermitage, is that book available on Amazon or was that just a limited run kind of a thing?
That was a limited run as well. I think I've seen them on eBay. I don't know if it's on Amazon or not. I think Halcyon Gallery have some left.
Okay.
But with my next show, there'll be a book with my next show, a new one.
Okay.
Because I've got quite a bit of new work.
All right. Anne Bengard in Berlin. Anne is another friend of the podcast on Patreon. Thanks for the tea, Anne. Says, so many great questions have been asked already, and actually a lot of my questions were already answered in the last podcast with Mitch. So thank you for that. And thank you for doing your homework, Anne. I'd be interested to know if or how the pandemic has affected Mitch's practice and business. Here in Berlin, I'm noticing a great shift to new media art and online/VR and digital exhibitions. Do you feel this is a shift also taking place in the UK? And what are your thoughts on this way of presenting and viewing art, particularly with paintings? Thank you for doing a second podcast, Mitch. Your words in the last one really helped me overcome my fear of learning oil painting and has advanced my practice and career tremendously. And thanks again, John, for making the podcast possible.
So. Well, thanks, Anne, for saying such nice things. Well, I think a lot more stuff has to move online. And I think lots of shows, lots of exhibitions will be online for the foreseeable future, over the next 6 months, year, something like that. It's not ideal, but things normally born out of necessity will work in the end. So there will be, I think all the online stuff will get much better, but it's like Instagram and social media, you know, people, you're looking at art on your phone on this tiny screen and it's not how it's meant to look. So yep. I mean, most of my paintings are huge, really, and it's in this tiny little screen. In regards to how the pandemic affected my practice, well, when we were in lockdown, well, when I was able to come out of isolation and I was feeling better and I started to come to work, I did another couple of weeks of just working about 4 hours a day, and then I would go home. And then when I was able to work full time, I'd get up at about 5 a.m., something like that, because we used to have a dog and I'd walk the dog first thing in the morning, and I would then go to work. And so I'd get up at 5, go to work, and then I would leave work at about 2 o'clock, something like that. So because we're living through history at the minute with the lockdown, and unprecedented, never happened in this country. So I was not going to leave my wife and child at home in lockdown and me just come to work, yes, have my short walk to the studio. So I want to be able to do a full day's work and then actually experience some of this lockdown together. So, and because of my flexibility, I was able to do that. So yeah, that's in that regard, that's what I did. My next exhibition has been postponed twice so far.
Yeah, I think it was just like very wasn't it around March or February, the first time? Yeah, yeah.
And it may have been, even before that, it may have been October, and then we decided to put it back, and then it was going to be March, April, and of course that's all gone. So, and then maybe we thought we could do it this autumn. But any kind of physical show that you can actually walk into, it may be next year, it may be spring next year. That's the earliest that we could be looking at, really.
Yeah. And is that, you know, like I know with the, that kind of practice where you, you know, you sell at shows, has that put a lot of pressure on you financially now? Like, because, you know, if you've been working away for 2 years for a show that was supposed to happen and then isn't going to happen for maybe another 2 years, that can be hard for a lot of artists. Very hard.
Well, I'm very lucky at the prices that I can achieve with my work. And I'm not an extravagant person, so I'm able to just carry on, continue producing my work and hold tight until I get another show.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And have you had much dialogue with your Halcyon? Like how has it gone for them? Because like your story is just one of many for them, and their story, like how are they getting on?
Yeah, well, they're on it. They're on it. I mean, straight from the off, speaking to my my liaison there, they right from the off, they were going online, and that was the way forward. And individual appointments with clients and stuff like that. So they're looking at stuff born out of necessity to work around it and maybe catch up with things that were lacking before in certain areas of the way that they do business. But they're completely on it.
Yeah. Do they only sell your work in shows, or have they been in touch with somebody, you know, we think some, you know, we'd like to sell this particular painting, or do you show them your work as you're going along, or where the show has gone?
I'll show them my work as it goes along, but then also because we've had a working relationship for so long, there's a trust element. So they know that I'm here getting on with the work, and there's work going on. So they don't necessarily feel the need to encourage me or keep tabs on me, I suppose, and things like that. Yeah. So,
but have they been in touch saying they, you know, we want to sell this painting or that painting, or do you have something we can sell? You've got a collector who really loves your work, or like, do you sell between shows?
Oh yeah, sell between shows. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But then also there's talks of what's the best thing to do. Is it best to sell it between shows or keep all the shows back ready for, because also they're a business and they have a lot of clients, and they look after their clients, and there might be a situation where more than one client wants a certain piece of work.
Yeah.
So in that regard, that's where they come into their own.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like not so much because not so much in your case, because you're at the kind of higher end of price bracket, but it seems like, just from the artists I'm talking to, that with this kind of no shows anymore or no physical shows anymore, that it's almost like they're sort of shifting from that model to much more of a sort of somewhere between like Apple and Etsy kind of model, meaning you know, like, yeah, it's nice to go to an Apple store, but nobody would want to go to one now, but that doesn't stop people buying one online, and you still know it's going to be lovely. So similarly, like people who love art, like, yeah, it'd be lovely to see this in person, but I'd still like to buy a painting. So I'm going to look online, much like you do with Etsy, and, you know, I'll get into a little dialogue with the artist, and if everything's good, then we'll just go ahead and buy that way rather than go to a show and do it in that way, you know?
Yeah. And a lot of artists now are just, they're not using galleries, and they're just selling straight from their social media accounts and their websites, aren't they?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So last question. So I started asking this question at the beginning of the lockdown, and I'm not sure how relevant it is, because what I was asking people was, okay, we've gone into lockdown, and it's a time of great change. What would you like the world to look like when we come out of lockdown? Not what do you think it's going to look down, but, you know, it's a chance for things to change. What things would you like to change? But now we've kind of gone on a little bit. I still think we've got a great opportunity to change. So yeah, let's go with that. What would you like? What would you like to have changed in the world, say this time next year? I'm not asking to forecast. I'm asking you to, like, you know, wish list, you know, magic wand, John's magic wand. I can make it happen. What do you think? What would you like?
I think the biggest one is just for everyone, for there to be less. There's a massive divide at the minute, politically, and that's overspilled into everyday life. And instead of it being right and left, if we can, there doesn't seem to be any politicians in the centre. So we need people in the centre, really. And if we can have someone that can come forward and find a common ground for the people on either side of it, then I think that's the way forward. If people could just be a bit more tolerant to other people's beliefs, other people's ideologies, and just find a bit more tolerance, really.
Beautiful. Lovely. Okay. Well, it's been a delight talking to you again. If someone wants to get to look at your work, what's the best place for them to do that?
Instagram, really.
Instagram.
So, yeah. My website's about a date at the minute, and I'm not really on Facebook.
No, you're not. Facebook's gone.
I've got a page, but I switched to Instagram a few years ago just because at the time there was a lot less opinion on it and a lot more art.
Yeah.
And it was just nicer. It was just nicer and just nicer to look at, really. So
yeah.
I just never went back. I never went back, really.
Okay, so it's Mitch_Griffiths_paint if you're looking for Mitch. I'll put a link in the show notes, and I'll put a link to Mitch's out of date website. So yeah, lovely talking to you as usual, Mitch. I'm glad you're well, and for me the most enjoyable part of talking to you, apart from your mastery and your great skill, is just your priorities. I really appreciate your priorities, that it's people that you love first and relationships, which are, to me, these are the important things. These are the lasting things. And then art, secondary. So that is beautiful.
Yeah. I didn't always get it right, but you learn with experience.
Yeah. So, yeah, I hope you stay well and get rid of the last little niggly bits of that. And I'm sure we'll keep in touch. But, yeah, we'll say goodbye for now.
Thanks, John.
All right, bye.
Cheers. Bye.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti.
Actually, I'd prefer a cup of tea. A cup of tea would be lovely. So, yeah, just a little reminder, mainly because every second or third person who becomes a patron has got in touch with me and said, you know what, I've been listening to your podcast for ages, and I didn't become a patron, not because I don't have the money, not because I don't think it's great, I just didn't get around to it. So this is a little friendly reminder that if you'd like to be a patron, you'd like to buy me a cup of tea, go to patreon.com/John Dalton, gently does it, all one word. Or follow the link in the show notes to become a patron. I would really appreciate it if you could do that, particularly if you've been meaning to and you just haven't got around to it. It would be great. It would mean a lot to me. All right. Thank you. Bye. We are the Argyle Pimps. The buys to drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps. The buys to drink. Come on, buys to drink. Come on, buys to drink. We are the Argyle Pimps. The buys to drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle.